really work. It's an art that needs a scroll. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high.
Hey, good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is 9 o'clock on your Thursday morning, a busy Thursday morning. We're a half hour away from Per Fogering hosting Fight the Empire, focusing on Ukraine and beyond. At 10 o'clock, join us for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Flashpoints happens at 10:15. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman speaks with Kelly Link about her new novel, Get in Trouble. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, author Renee Watson discusses her novel, This Side of Home. That is all coming up, but first, it's Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. Stick around, that's next on KBOO.
Ear to the streets.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the streets.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, here it is, March 5th, 9:02 Pacific Time. The Obama Justice Department says there will be no charges against the Ferguson killer cop. This follows on the heels of the locals saying no bill. Article by Andre Damon in WSWS.org. World Socialist says the U.S. Justice Department announced Wednesday it would not bring federal charges against Darren Wilson, the Ferguson, Missouri police officer who fired at least six bullets into Michael Brown last August, killing an unarmed teenager. The announcement is the culmination of months in which the Obama administration sought to posture as the defender of minority youth, all the while solidarizing with the police. The decision to exonerate Wilson was announced by Attorney General Eric Holder, who served as the White House point man at the height of the daily protests in the St. Louis suburb following Brown's murder. After Brown's killing, Holder went to Ferguson to put on a show of support for the right to protest. At the same time, he signaled the federal government's support for the Missouri State Police captain, who presided over the mass arrest of demonstrators and virtual lockdown of the town by National Guard troops and police armed with military-grade weapons. Speaking for myself, more on another lockdown. And are we getting used to lockdowns? Returning to the article, the announcement that the government will not prosecute Wilson despite multiple eyewitness accounts describing his shooting of Brown as arbitrary and unprovoked is a result of political, not legal considerations. It is an unambiguous statement of support for the institution of the police and forces of state violence in general under conditions of mounting social anger and class tensions. In its announcement, an 86-page report it issued explaining its rationale, the administration lined up fully behind last year's rigged grand jury proceedings that resulted in a decision not to bring criminal charges against Wilson. The Justice Department did not differ. The report did not differ in any substantial way from the arguments presented by the notoriously pro-police St. Louis County prosecutor to justify the refusal to charge Wilson. This is despite the fact that prosecutor Robert McCulloch subsequently admitted that he knowingly presented to grand jurors perjured testimony supporting the police officer. The first piece of evidence, and that word is in quotation marks, evidence presented in the Justice Department report, is Wilson's self-serving account of the events of August 9th. At the same time, the report discounts the testimony of nearly two dozen witnesses who claim that Brown had his hands up when he was killed. The decision by the Ferguson grand jury, followed by a similar decision by a New York grand jury not to indict the police officer who choked Eric Garner to death, amounted to a carte blanche for police departments across the country to beat and kill as they see fit. Now the Obama administration has given the federal government's de facto seal of approval for police violence and murder. Go ahead, boys. Returning to the text, in effect, the administration has demonstrated its backing for the transformation of the police into a militarized occupation force in working-class communities across the country. The epidemic of police killings has continued unabated, Damon writes, with the latest atrocity occurring only days ago when Los Angeles police beat, tased, and shot to death a homeless man on city's Skid Row. The decision not to prosecute Wilson was announced alongside a separate Justice Department report accusing the Ferguson Police Department of wrongful arrests, harassment, and the use of court fees to raise revenue. That report, which defines violations of democratic rights by the police entirely in racial terms, was released to provide a smokescreen for the decision not to prosecute the killer of Michael Brown. The report on the Ferguson Police Department highlights the administration's cynical use of racial politics to obscure the more fundamental class issues underlying police violence and provide a political cover for its own assault on the democratic rights and social conditions of the working class. Its main recommendation is for the hiring of more African-American and minority police, as though it makes a difference whether a worker or youth is being brutalized by a black cop or a white one. The juxtaposition of the two reports intended to divert attention from the administration's endorsement of police violence actually underscores the complete compatibility of racial and identity politics with the most ferocious attacks on working people of all races and backgrounds. That's where I differ from the writer Andrew Damon of WSWS.org. I think it has a hell of a lot more to do with race. But you can read that entire article at WSWS.org. And so long as I'm using that website, I have a list of questions about the Tsarnaev trial, the Boston Marathon bombing trial. Kids now on stage in Boston with a supporting cast of closed streets, barricades, and helicopters on constant patrol. And the questions are, why did the FBI and CIA fail to respond to warnings from Russia's security agency FSB in 2011 and 2012 concerning Tamerlan Tsarnaev's support for Islamist, separatist, and terrorist organizations in Russia's North Caucasian regions of Chechnya and Dagestan? Why did they ignore Russia's request that Tsarnaev be prevented from traveling to these regions? Why did the FBI clear Tamerlan Tsarnaev of harboring terrorist sympathies in 2011 after supposedly carrying out an intensive investigation? Why did the agency claim there was no derogatory information against him, even though it suspected him of having participated in the Waltham, Massachusetts murder of three Jewish men, including a best friend, on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks? Why was he allowed to travel to Dagestan in January of 2012 without even being questioned at the airport? He remained there for 6 months and reportedly made contact with Islamist groups that have carried out terror attacks against Russian targets. Why was he allowed to return to the U.S. without even being stopped at the airport and questioned on his return? And speaking for myself, when I came back from Cuba, boy, I was examined. I remember backing off the customs officials at the airport by yelling at them, "Would you like to search up my blank again because I've been to Cuba?" Because they really would have preferred that had gone down more quietly. They weren't really happy that I had said that. But this guy gets to come back from Dagestan, no questions. Why, continuing with the questions from Barry Gray, Why did the FBI, CIA, and Homeland Security Department fail to inform their state and local counterparts on the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force of their contacts with the Tamerlan Sarnaev prior to the Boston Marathon? Well, that sentence is bollocksed up well enough that I think I'll just read it again. Why did the FBI, CIA, and Homeland Security Department fail to inform their state and local counterparts on the Boston Joint Terrorism Task Force of their contacts with Tamerlan Sarnaev prior to the Boston Marathon? And Barry Gray writes, these unanswered questions strongly suggest that U.S. intelligence was seeking to use Tamerlan Sarnaev to further its covert anti-Russian operations among the Chechen and Dagestan separatists. These regions also supplied many of the foreign fighters recruited by the CIA for its proxy war for regime change against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. This connection is underscored by another critical fact ignored by the U.S. media, the role of Ruslan Sami, the uncle of the Sarnaev brothers. In the 1990s, Sarni ran a U.S. group called the Congress of Chechen International Organizations, which helped supply anti-Russian insurgents in Chechnya with military equipment. The organization was registered at the home of his father-in-law, Graham Fuller. Fuller had been the vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA under President Reagan, and had worked for the agency in a number of countries, including serving as CIA station chief in Kabul. Pretty good questions, if you ask me. Find that article at wsws.org. Time is 10 minutes after 9. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Turning to commondreams.org, Rachel Nussbaum writes, do you hear that? It's starting, the predictable drumbeat of dire warnings about what will happen if portions of the Patriot Act, the post-9/11 law being used to conduct controversial NSA dragnet surveillance, are allowed to expire on June 1st. It's already begun. James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, issued what is likely to be the first of many vague warnings from the intelligence community on Monday. Faced with the expiration of part of the Patriot Act that allows the bulk collection of information about Americans' phone calls, Clapper brought out the favored hypothetical of the surveillance hawk. An unspecified attack will occur, which would have been prevented if Congress had reauthorized the dragnet collection of Americans' phone calls. Quote, if that tool is taken away from us and some untoward incident happens that could have been thwarted if we had had it, I hope that everyone involved in that decision assumes the responsibility. End quote. James Clapper. There is just one problem with this particular bit of emotional blackmail, however. The pesky, rather inconvenient fact is that the government's mass surveillance programs operating under Section 215 of the Patriot Act have never stopped an act of terrorism. That is not the opinion of NSA's most ardent critics, but rather the findings of the President's own review board and the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. This program has had over a decade to prove its value, and yet there is no evidence that it has helped identify a terrorism suspect or made a concrete difference in the outcome of a counterterrorism investigation. In less than 3 months, Section 215 will expire unless Congress takes action to extend that authority. As that deadline approaches, we will be hearing more from folks in the intelligence community who would like to see the program continued indefinitely. So if you're talking to your Congress critters, this is something to bring up. Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Number to call 503-231-8187. Pardon me. Arctic ice is thinning. While the steady disappearance of sea ice in the Arctic has been one of hallmark effects of global warming, research shows it is not only covering less of the planet, but it's also getting significantly thinner. That makes it more susceptible to melting, potentially altering local ecosystems, shipping routes, and ocean and atmospheric patterns. This is from The Guardian. Has a lot of good articles like this on science. If you want to know what the latest is in Ukraine, I would not turn to The Guardian, unless you just want to know what the latest on the Western propaganda is about Ukraine, in which case it's a really rich and detailed source. But I do have a couple articles from The Guardian, and continuing with the one I was mentioning, Arctic ice is thinning. New data compiled from a range of sources, from Navy submarines to satellites, suggests that thinning is happening much faster than models have estimated, according to a study aiming to link those disparate data sources for the first time. University of Washington researchers Ron Lindsay and Axel Schweiger calculated that in the central part of the Arctic Ocean basin, sea ice has thinned by 65% since 1975. During September, when the ice reaches its annual minimum, ice thickness is down by a stunning 85%. No big deal, though. Don't know why people are getting all worked up about. Returning to the article, the information is key in determining when parts of the Arctic may become ice-free for at least part of the year in the coming century. While the ice's extent is readily visible from satellites, ice thickness has been more difficult to measure, and it has arguably been the more important dimension, and measuring the volume of ice being lost. In estimating ice thickness, satellites must try to gauge thickness differences of just a few feet from hundreds of miles above the planet's surface. More on that article at The Guardian. Also from The Guardian. And more or less on the same topic, a controversial American businessman dumped around 100 tons of iron sulfate into the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, sounds like deja vu. He's done it again. Returning to the article, as part of a geoengineering scheme off the west coast of Canada in July. Lawyers, environmentalists, and civil society groups are calling it a blatant violation of two international moratoria, and the news is likely to spark outrage at a United Nations environmental summit taking place in India this week. Satellite images appear to confirm the claim by Californian Russ George that the iron has spawned an artificial plankton bloom as large as 10,000 square kilometers. And if you pull that article up at The Guardian and look at the picture, well, there, with the color mapping, you will see 10,000 square kilometers of plankton bloom. The intention is for the plankton to absorb carbon dioxide and then sink to the ocean bed. A geoengineering technique known as ocean fertilization that he hopes will net lucrative carbon credits. George is the former chief executive of Planktos Incorporated, whose previous failed efforts to conduct large-scale commercial dumps near the Galapagos and Canary Islands led to his vessels being barred from ports by the Spanish and Ecuadorian governments. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency warned him that flying a U.S. flag for his Galapagos project would violate U.S. laws, and his activities are credited in part to the passing of international moratoria at the United Nations, limiting ocean fertilization experiments. Speaking for myself, though, he doesn't give a damn. He's got to march on forward. A legend in his own mind. But returning to the article, and quoting John Cullen, it is difficult, if not impossible, to detect and describe important effects that we know might occur months or years later. Some possible effects, such as deep water oxygen depletion and the alteration of distant food webs, should rule out ocean manipulation. History is full of examples of ecological manipulations that backfired, end quote. George says his team of unidentified scientists has been monitoring the results of the biggest ever geoengineering experiment with equipment loaned from the U.S. agencies like NASA and National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration. He told The Guardian that it is the most substantial ocean restoration project in history and has collected a greater density and depth of scientific data than ever before, end quote. And Mr. George goes on saying, we've gathered data targeting all the possible fears that have been raised about ocean fertilization, and the news is all good news, all around for the planet, end quote. Speaking for myself, I guess he's never heard the word eutrophication, but returning to the article, the dump took place from a fishing boat in an eddy 200 nautical miles west of the islands of Haida Gwaii, one of the world's most celebrated diverse ecosystems, where George convinced the local council of an indigenous village to establish the Haida Salmon Restoration Corporation to channel more than $1 million of its own funds into the project. The president of the Haida Nation, Gujaal, said the village was told the dump would environmentally benefit the ocean, which is crucial to their livelihood and culture. Gujaal said, quote, the village people voted to support what we were told was a salmon enhancement project and would not have agreed if they had been told of any potential negative effects or that it was in breach of an international convention, end quote. International legal experts say George's project has contravened the UN's Convention on Biological Diversity and London Convention on the Dumping of Wastes at Sea, which both prohibit for-profit ocean fertilization activities. But no one seems to be going up there and stopping him. The time is 9:18. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Dan's on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Glad to hear you're offering us your usual salutary dose of vinegar this morning. I'm stealing this from something I read, but I thought it was worth repeating. Given the recent attempt by Bibi Netanyahu to hijack American foreign policy, let's do a thought experiment here. And as a different president, President Bush, the younger, was leading us, Bush and Judy Miller of the New York Times were leading us to war in Iraq. Imagine that the Democrats, who controlled Congress then, invited the president of France to say, wait a minute, I want to influence American foreign policy with my address before Congress and tell the American president what to do. Imagine the outrage. And it's a pretty analogous situation.
Why is it okay for those bootlickers to take foreign money? I'm talking about Republicans.
Right. Well, just, you know, they're both Tweedledum and Tweedledee, but the rules still are different for the Republicans.
Good point. Well, as long as you bring that up, let me quote Haaretz. This is Benjamin Netanyahu in 2002, and I'm going to quote him, and you tell me if it sounds familiar. Before the UN, he said, there's no question that, fill in the blank, has not given up on his nuclear program, not whatsoever. There is also no question that he was not satisfied with the arsenal of chemical and biological weapons that he had and was trying to perfect them constantly. So I think, frankly, it is not serious to assume that this man, who 20 years ago was very close to producing an atomic bomb, spent the last 20 years sitting on his hands. He has not, and every indication we have is that he is pursuing with abandon, pursuing with every ounce of effort, the establishment of weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. Of course, he was talking about Saddam.
Let me ask you a question.
What result did that have?
Right. Let me ask you a question.
Okay.
What are the chances in the next 18 months of a serious military strike on Iran?
Greater than zero, which is not acceptable.
I'll let you go. Thanks for your program.
You're welcome. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And Garrett is on the air.
Yeah. I saw something on YouTube a while ago that kind of had me thinking ever since. It was a thought experiment about police violence.
Okay.
And it started with a question. If you had a family member who was getting beaten to death by the cops right in front of you,
like Mamiya's brother,
what could you do to stop the murder? And it went on and on. And provably, if you try to stop the police from doing something that they want to do with a little bit of force, they'll kick you down to the curb. They'll handcuff you. It doesn't work. And if you go further than that, then, you know, it's a big mess. So what can you do to stop a police murder in progress? Because obviously, cameras pointing at them can stop them some of the time, but we have plenty of footage of them killing people right in front of a camera. So how do you stop a police murder without yourself becoming a cop killer?
Well, I don't think you can without deploying superior weaponry, which means a firefight. And I've tried to warn for years now that people being people and the U.S. people being rather well armed, sooner or later this will result in firefights. And I really think we should not go there. But the closest thing, you know, as you intimated, the closest thing you can do, closest best thing, is to videotape them, and better yet, have more than one. And people have had to do things like pop SD cards into their mouths to fool the police and keep them from getting hold of the video cameras, because they will just snatch them and they really don't care.
But what if it's your son?
Well, that goes back to the question. You can put more emotional charge into it, but it still logically follows. You can't really stop them. You can videotape them and hope, you know, for some simulacrum of justice, which you will not get from white people in a jury. And, you know, those are the choices that you have.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Scientists were baffled last July when they discovered three giant holes in the ground in the Yamal Peninsula in northern Siberia. Now, with the help of satellite imagery, researchers have located four additional craters, and they believe there may be dozens more in the region. That has them calling for an urgent investigation to protect residents living in the area. Quoting Professor Vasily, well, I'll try to pronounce his last name, Bogoyevlinsky, yeah, sure. Corresponding member of the Russian Academy of Sciences and deputy director of the Moscow-based Oil and Gas Research Institute. Quote, "I am sure there are more craters on Yamal. We just need to search for them. I suppose there could be 20 or 30 more craters. It is important not to scare people," he says, "but to understand that it is a very serious problem and we must research this," end quote. Researchers ventured deep inside one of the holes last November, collecting data in an effort to learn why the holes formed. The leading theory is that the holes were created by gas explosions that were created by underground heat or by rising air temperatures associated with climate change, and that was from the Siberian Times, as reported in the Huffington Post. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Turning to the soccer.is, Ukraine sit rep. By the way, stay tuned because Parafogging is coming up with much more information on this. And this is the other perspective on it. As of today, the situation in Ukraine is deceptively calm. If the Novorossians have completed the withdrawal of their heavy weapons, by the way, that's who the Guardian would call the rebels, have completed the withdrawal of their heavy weapons, the junta forces, by all accounts, did not. They did withdraw some, but most, if it was not so much a case of withdrawal as a case of relocation and even a rotation of forces. The OSCE knows about it, but there's nothing that they can do. Furthermore, there's been a flurry of behind-the-scenes contacts between Hollande, Merkel, Putin, and Poroshenko, and between Kerry and Lavrov, but with nothing substantial revealed, at least not to the general public. And the soccer, whoever he is, says it is hard for me to believe that the junta is preparing a spring offensive after being so thoroughly thrashed last summer and this winter, but then this begs the question of what is really worse for the freaks in power, a military defeat or a peace which would leave them one-on-one with their extremely dissatisfied population. Speaking of the winter offensive, Uncle Martin has posted an English translation of Colonel Kassar's detailed analysis, and so you can find that at the soccer.is. And he writes, in the meantime, in the junta-controlled part of the Ukraine, by which he means the West, the persecution of the Orthodox population by Uniate thugs continues unabated. In the latest case, human rights activists from Kyiv have reported that Orthodox Christians were assaulted and threatened inside their church during a religious ceremony. And U.S. and EU leaders have declared that they are looking into more sanctions against Russia if the Minsk II agreement fails in Novorossiya. Apparently, they are assuming that this could only happen by the fault of the Novorossians and Russia. In the meantime, the internet domain names registered in Crimea are being removed by ICANN. And he writes, the bottom line is the situation appears calm, but since nothing has really changed, the calm is probably temporary at best. Number to call with your comments and questions. And as I said, Parafogging is coming up next. And Stephen Zunes writes in commondreams.org that Netanyahu is still swaying the U.S. Congress. More on his speech. It constituted a major breach of protocol, he writes, in that it was the first time that the Speaker of the House has extended such an invitation without consulting the administration or the opposition party. It took place 2 weeks prior to national elections in the foreign leader's home country, thereby giving the impression of an endorsement of his campaign by what Netanyahu noted was the most important legislative body in the world. An invitation to speak before a joint session of Congress is a rare honor. Indeed, the only other foreign leaders besides Netanyahu to appear before such a joint session of Congress on three occasions was Winston Churchill. Underscoring the high regard Congress has for the right-wing Israeli leader, Speaker of the House John Boehner presented him with a bust of the late British Prime Minister. Most strikingly, Netanyahu is the only foreign leader to have been invited to address a joint session of Congress with the express purpose of undermining U.S. foreign policy. In this case, negotiations on Iran's nuclear program currently entering their sensitive final stages. Some pundits have speculated on the reaction if the Democrats had invited French President Jacques Chirac, note the previous phone call, to criticize President George Bush's Iraq policy, or Costa Rican President Oscar Arias to criticize Ronald Reagan's Central America policy. So there's more on that article at commondreams.org. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Parafogging coming right up next at 9:30. We're going out to you via the terrestrial transmitters at 90.7 and other frequencies and via the World Wide Web to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compas.